You're listening to Lost Voices, an untold story of the South Asian diaspora, a podcast about demystifying archives and the South Asian experience in Canada. I'm Alicia. I'm a journalist and editor from Toronto. I think a lot about how storytelling can cut through the noise and stand a chance at survival in the attention economy and have a lasting impact. Thanks for joining me. Now let me tell you what this show is all about. So there's this thing called the Gwilym Project. It's a research project based at McGill University in Montreal that brings together letters and drawings scattered all over the world, like a digital archive. The project is about the lives of the Gwilym sisters, two British gals in 19th century Madras, India. McGill has a bunch of archival material from that time period. So does the South Asia Museum in the UK. They have one sister's album that she sent home, and the British Library's got a massive pile of letters from the Gwilym sisters that make up a big chunk of this archival material. Their letters offer us a glimpse into life in pre-colonial India. I like to think of this as today's equivalent of two well-to-do white girls from the UK backpacking to India after graduation. Obviously, they'd be documenting their entire trip on social media. This is what I imagine their photos to look like in their phone. Hundreds of selfies along the beach, artsy photos of flowers and narrow side streets, and perfectly angled outfit of the day photos in front of colorful architecture. In some ways, the Gwilym sisters and I are alike. In those letters, they wrote in great detail about the clothes they wore, what the weather was like on their adventures, and the dances and parties they attended. I do that too. Probably in really long essay captions on Instagram. Okay, I'm kidding. Those are the worst. But you get the idea. Listen to this diary entry from Mary Gwilym about her very active social life.
Dinners and balls are very frequent, and dancing is much pleasanter here than you would think it could be in so warm a climate, as the rooms are quite open and the evenings are very cool and pleasant. In most of the dining rooms, they have two men who stand in the opposite corners of the room with very large fans made in the form of flags. They are much ornamented with painting and brass. They are made of a sort of grass, which when dampened, gives out a very agreeable perfume. These cool the room very much. Most ladies have servants who fan them during dinner and stand behind their chairs for that purpose, so you see, great pains is taken to prevent our feeling any inconvenience from the heat.
So having a personal fanner really brings home the things we don't have in common. But there's one thing that's painfully clear about all of this old material. I'm learning about a period of Indian history through the eyes of two sisters from England. I'm not a history major, but it's been well established that the history we learned in school was taught and is still taught through a colonial lens. Of course, historical material documented by people in India does exist around this time period, but not many Western libraries and archives have any of this material. Maybe libraries in India have it, but it's generally not available online. Let's say you did get your hands on some of it. Chances are it would be in Telugu, which was the local language in Madras at the time. So you can see how you're pretty much limited to learning about your own cultural history through colonial sources. I chatted with Victoria Dickinson. She's professor of practice at McGill University, and she got the grant for the Gwilym Project. She advocates for more inclusivity in how history is presented, specifically in museums.
You know, you're often using the records of settlers, you know, or even visitors, but you're trying to get underneath them to find out what was really, you know, what. If there are no written records and no textual records, not even any oral records for early material, and no visual records, how do you get at that early history? Well, you can only get it through what remains. And so this is, in a sense, what we said we could do here. Can we get underneath the text and the images to find out more? These are descriptions that, for the most part, were not permitted to men. These entrees were not permitted to men, so that in fact, the Gwilym sisters had this kind of privileged look into the society. They had some knowledge of local culture and language, and they were sympathetic observers. So that's the perspective we've been taking, is what can we learn? We were very inspired, at least I was recently, by a conference at Kew Gardens, where they talked about decolonizing the archives and how they were doing it. And we're talking, in this case, archives of lists of plants, you know, I mean, you know, records of, you know, gardens. How do you decolonize that? But what one young woman had done was she went through all their archives and found that the archives written by the British had all these records of the gardeners who were mainly Indian, and not always, but mainly, and of their illnesses, their time off, their families, all sorts of things. And she was able to reconstruct the life of the Indian gardeners at the beginning of the end of the 19th century through these really basically colonial records of employment. So this is the kind of thing too, this sort of notion of, can we have a different perspective that broadens our knowledge of the world by using these texts? So that's what we're trying to do with this.
Like Victoria said, the process of decolonizing an archive with her academic expertise definitely takes work. It requires open-mindedness and a willingness to appreciate other worldviews. But this unlearning isn't unique to academia. It's happening in my industry, the media industry as well. I chatted about this with Olivia Bowden, a reporter at the Toronto Star, and Shetu Modi, a Toronto-based video producer. There's definitely been a rise in South Asian-centered media outlets like Brown Girl Magazine, The Juggernaut, The Aerogram. Obviously, it's really important that these outlets are centering their reporting on the Brown experience. What makes, I think, these outlets so special is that they're normalizing and validating our life experiences. And I think both of you prioritize marginalized voices in your reporting. But what I find interesting is, because in a larger sense, with this podcast, we're looking at this colonial research through an academic lens to look to the media industry to help sort of uncover or, you know, tease out the voices that are often the white voices. Because so much of what we do is make sure that people of color and underrepresented communities aren't in the margins.
Hi, I'm Olivia Bowden. I'm a staff reporter at the Toronto Star. No, I think that's really important because historical fields too have the same problem as journalism, in that it's, you know, majority white. So I think having that kind of lens isn't a go-to. If they read, you know, say media from The Juggernaut and they see that kind of framing, I think what would help is if they just bring on more diverse academics in the first place, because I understand if this isn't your worldview, then it's not going to be, you know, your instinct, and you're really going to have to go out of your way not to make the history sort of Eurocentric, especially when the documents are from the perspective of white people. So I think they're going to have to approach it, you know, very critically and do things, you know, differently than maybe what they're used to, which is important.
Hi, I'm Shetu Modi, and I'm a writer, director, and editor. I agree about having like more diversity just in academia. I think that would help, especially because I don't necessarily think like white academics would have access to the same communities and even like Facebook groups that we would have access to. For example, I'm part of a BIPOC TV and film group on Facebook, as well as the South Asians in Entertainment group. Obviously, those spaces are for BIPOC people and South Asian people, and they're exclusive spaces. So that people can be, freer in their conversation. I don't think if academia is all white, they're not going to have insight into any of those conversations or even like be privy to them.
As a second-gen Canadian with South Asian heritage, I often ask myself what it means to be brown. I was raised by an Indian mom who grew up in northern Alberta. She didn't know anyone who looked like her. I mean, there were no South Asian families in the prairies at the start of the 60s. At the time, a dashing Quebecois politician named Pierre Trudeau, you might have heard of him, had transfixed the nation. He championed relaxed immigration policies and inserted multiculturalism into the Canadian national identity. Trudeau mania was altering the country's cultural landscape. The left was mesmerized. The right rolled its eyes. The young politician was often swarmed by throngs of youth. So Canada, land of lumberjacks, farmers, and fishermen, was changing. My dad was born and raised in India. After finishing up his degree in New York, he met my mom and they got married in Ottawa and had me. When I ask my dad what his childhood was like, it feels kind of surreal. He went to boarding school in Nainital, a Himalayan resort town. It was a 7-hour car ride from his home in Delhi. He always tells me he basically went to Hogwarts. The Great Hall looks identical to the one in his school. When we're allowed to travel again, Nainital is the first place I'd love to visit. And that's the thing about being second gen. Naturally, I feel removed from my dad's birthplace, but I have a burning desire to see it for myself. I'm sure anyone who's a child of immigrants can relate to that. So much of the South Asian experience is different for everyone. We're all South Asian, obviously all identified differently, but we do have overlapping experiences amongst all of us. Kind of on a lighter note, I love talking to other South Asians specifically about some of the quirks about how our family preserves personal history. For example, you know, my dad recently just told me he doesn't fully believe it, but his sister told me in India that his birthday is wrong. His passport, the dates don't match up. And it's probably because they had to change his birth date so he could get into the right boarding school and get in at the right time so he could go to school with his siblings. And that is something that's super common. I'm sure tons of other people can relate to that.
Yes, definitely know him. It's the same with my grandfather. I think he has the same passport birthday as like 3 of his siblings. So it looks like they were all just happened to be born on the same day, but it was also so he could go to school earlier.
We don't even know when my ba was born. Like we estimate it was around 1914, but we never, like there isn't a record of her birth. So when she like passed away in 2003, we think she was 89, but we're not positive.
Pictures of my dad from these times supposedly exist, but I've never seen them. If they do, there's very few. Photographic documentation was not high on the list of priorities at the time. So my dad exists in a hiccup of reality, the product of tales spun by those around him. I do, however, have fond memories of my dad videotaping all of my dance and piano recitals when I was a kid. Every birthday party and every family vacation, he'd turn on his narrator voice and document the big and the small. He was especially proud of the fact that our JVC camcorder neatly fit in its own leather bag. My dad isn't a social media kind of guy, but that camcorder was certainly his way of preserving our childhood forever.
We just packed the trunk. It's August 2003 and we are in Calgary. It's the second day of our vacation, and we'll be driving through the Rocky Mountains. We're heading to Vancouver on Highway 1. We're hoping the drive is 10 hours or so. It's a beautiful sunny day, no clouds at all.
Unlike my dad, my mom has albums and albums of pictures from her childhood. Whenever I look at them, it's a visceral reminder that she grew up in a Canada that looked very different from the one I grew up in. It's funny how those photos, neatly kept in a bookshelf, would probably garner hundreds of likes on Instagram today. Throwback Thursday, anyone? Do people even still do that? Sahaj Kohli is the founder of Brown Girl Therapy, the first and largest mental health community for children of immigrants. You can find it on Instagram at Brown Girl Therapy. We talked about how millennials and the South Asian diaspora are using social media today. It goes a lot deeper than likes.
You know, bicultural and multicultural folks, we're constantly experiencing what is known as bicultural straddling. So we're in a perpetual war of negotiation with two or more cultures. And so who we are around will obviously impact the way that we feel like we can relate to one identity, one culture, how we want to be seen, perceived. And as humans, we are all motivated by something, right? We're motivated by achievement, we're motivated by power, by change. But for many of us who are navigating multiple cultures and identities, we're also motivated by affiliation. So many of us have grown up in households where we're expected to act in certain ways, we're expected to uphold certain values, hide parts of our culture or history, you know, because we didn't want to get bullied in school. And a need for affiliation replicates in these online spaces. We all have this need to be accepted, to feel a sense of belonging. So the one thing I really like about social media, of course, there are many pros and cons to it, but the one thing that I've really enjoyed as a millennial is this influx of cultural and identity-driven communities. So these communities allow people to explore kind of in a low stakes way. You know, there's a potential for anonymity. There's potential for never having to comment, to engage, but really just witnessing other people's conversations, the content, the resources, and being able to say, where do I fit in? What does this feel like to me? Does this feel good? Do I want to include myself more in these types of conversations? Do I actually not relate to this? It really shines a light on so much for us personally and how we relate to our identities and allows us to reflect on what it means to reclaim who we are. So I think, you know, this need, our need for affiliation drives us to find people who look like us, who speak like us, who have shared experiences like us. And I see that so much in social media. And I think it can be such a beautiful way for us to build our own worthiness and anchor ourselves in who we are and who we want to be.
You know, as I became an adult in the last few years, it's become really, really important to me to embrace my South Asian heritage because I'm half South Asian. So my mom is South Asian and my dad is white with like British and Irish roots. Growing up, we've always just been closer to the Indian side. I spent my whole life, you know, going to temple, celebrating all kinds of traditions, doing puja with my grandmother. I'm, you know, quite white passing and, you know, my name is a pretty white name, Olivia. So, you know, on Twitter, I've put my middle names in my Twitter name to sort of indicate more my background because I think it's a crucial part of my identity. And for me, whether it's my coworkers, my friends, anyone else, it's really important to me that they recognize that part of me, even, you know, in terms of my sources as well. So, you know, that's why I put my full name in my Twitter bio.
It might not seem like a big deal, but intentionally choosing how we present ourselves on social media platforms, especially on Twitter as a journalist, is a professional archive of sorts. Future employers look us up, past colleagues stay up to date on our work, and we kind of all exist in this giant virtual living room where everyone says the same thing in different words. While our timelines on Twitter are ephemeral, what we share on our accounts inadvertently becomes an archive too. I use social media as a personal archiving tool. I think Instagram has really become a tool to document history, our personal histories, and a place to reclaim our ancestry in an accessible way. I think there's also been a steady rise of social media accounts, like the Brown History Podcast, there's the Sick Archive, there's the Lost Here Project. Kind of the running theme with all of these types of social media accounts and podcasts is they're retelling the South Asian experience, but through millennial voices. And because the South Asian diaspora is so diverse, it's so far-reaching, these accounts are working to document our rich histories in new and accessible ways. Why do you think this is so important right now in this moment?
I think every marginalized community is kind of in this moment where we are kind of reclaiming who we are, right? I mean, this goes way back to Indigenous people having their land and cultures and people taken from them. But I think now we are just in a political and social moment where every generation, when we look at Gen Z too, as young as Gen Z, are wanting to reclaim who they are and fight for social justice and fight for social advocacy. And that involves automatically identity and culture and community. And so as a millennial with a large social media following that is predominantly other millennials, I can say that the one thing I see anecdotally is that so many of us haven't had access to our own personal histories, let alone accurate histories of our general community or ancestors due to colonization, a lack of tangible resources, an inability to even access oral stories within our own families. And these accounts that you named, they give us a way to learn about our ancestors, to feel connected to where we come from, to understand our own intergenerational trauma or intergenerational narratives, the stories that have been told for centuries amongst people in our own community and culture. And that in itself, I keep using this term, reclaim our identity, but that is the most powerful thing that we are looking for. And it goes back to affiliation, wanting to have that sense of belonging and understanding. So many of us have felt displaced. And so a lot of these accounts are giving us something to kind of tether and anchor into, which I think is so powerful.
We don't have such a focus on written history and written preservation. So you know, not knowing the length of someone's life is not so absurd. You know, when my grandma tells me my nani, she will be like, well, when she went to the Ganges River to like put my grandpa's ashes into the water, she went into a cave. There was a man in the cave and he had a big book that was thousands of pages high, and it had some sort of note keeping or record keeping of everyone who's passed through. And she found like some sort of confirmation of her lineage or his last name to confirm like, okay, other people like decades before have come here to put their ashes. And that was like the closest she ever got to feeling like, okay, well, there was this other family that existed before. And it's kind of haunting to think about it, but also must have felt very, I guess, affirming to be in the middle of this holy water in this cave and to see, you know, her husband's last name live on, I guess. So much of the record keeping, especially from our grandparents' generation, is so fragmented. Millennials are creating archives of our own ancestries, and I think we're doing that primarily through social media. Is there a way that you think we're sort of creating an archive of ourselves and of our identities in any particular way that you maybe think you're doing that and you're not even aware you're doing it?
I think you've kind of mentioned this to us too with social media. Even on Instagram, there's an archive function. So, you know, just posting in general, I feel like, it, you know, it's creating an archive of our lives. And then, you know, when I archive posts, I keep them, you know, just for myself if they're old. And I guess it's just sort of, you know, the history of my life in the last few years.
Yeah, I agree. Social media. I also archived my family's entire collection of home videos, like from the 90s and the 2000s. So yeah, just creating an archive that it's not like an archive that's accessible to everyone, but it's still like a record of how we as an immigrant family grew up and lived this century and last.
Social media in general is now entirely a means for self-expression, mobilization, and resistance. Diasporic art on Instagram has blown up in recent years and has become a new engine and a defining trait of contemporary activism in general. It served as an entry point for deeper engagement by harnessing the power of people of color who are taking up traditionally unoccupied space online. I guess every social platform is an archiving tool if you think about it. Of the thousands of memories I have stored on my devices and in the cloud now, most are cloudless reminders of the past. When algorithms surface these images, my sense of time and place becomes warped. It's been especially pronounced during COVID for obvious reasons. In order to move forward in a pandemic, most of us were supposed to almost go nowhere. Time has become shapeless. Over the last several years, many apps have started to include their own features that automatically remind people of their digital histories, Facebook being, of course, the most obvious and influential. In 2015, it launched on this day after noticing that people were often looking back at old photos and posts. Notifications nudge you to revisit a photo from that day 2 years ago or even 7 years ago and reshare it. In 2016, Apple added a Memories tab to its Photos app with the release of iOS 10. 3 years later, Google added a feature that showed old photos at the top of the page. It's called, wait for it, Memories. Okay, so back to the Gwilym sisters. Imagine if they could tag the street markets they visited. Imagine for one brief moment if we had access to a cloud where all this photographic and written material was perfectly piled up for us to peruse and extract and interpret. Having this excessive amount of personal data documented on our grids and our timelines is just our way of telling our story, or at least some version of it. Now, what if archival material from the past, like the Gwilym Project, was retold or reimagined for today? What would that look like? In this case, how can we make sure South Asian voices are prioritized when we're talking about even this little sliver of Indian history? You and I can freely curate what we want the world to see and think about us. In the same way, my understanding of my Indian heritage and my Indian ancestry can only be understood by the privileged few who were able to witness it all those centuries ago. The breadth of information we now produce has outpaced our ability to preserve it for the future. Traditionally, librarians and archivists are the keepers of history. They, along with digital historians, are still trying to understand the challenges involved in modern preservation. But how can we make sure untold stories can survive? Over this series, that's exactly what we're going to try and figure out. Thanks for listening to Lost Voices, an untold story of the South Asian diaspora, a podcast by McGill University, hosted and written by me, Alicia, and produced in collaboration with Edit Audio. Special thanks to Anna, Richard, Steph, Lauren, Sophie, Kanika, Victoria, Olivia, Shetu, Sahaj, and others. In our next episode, we'll be talking about how the Gwilym Collection became a valuable piece of research in the first place, and why value is so tied to our understanding of history.